You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 113. Write what should not be forgotten. Isabel Allende.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft, it's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Let me ask you a question. How do you get a kick-ass Sundance premiering feature film made? Now, I'm not talking about the sanitized version, but the blood, sweat, tears, and hustle that actually made it happen. The Make Cool Shit podcast documents the making of a certified fresh breakout comedy horror, Scare Me, starring college humor icon Josh Rubin, The Boys' Aya Cash, and SNL's Chris Redd. This behind-the-scenes look is hosted by Aaron Hayafitz. Join him as he tears down the fourth wall of independent filmmaking. Check out the Make Cool Shit podcast on Spotify or wherever you enjoy your podcast. Well, guys, today on the show, we have screenwriter and author Paul Chicklick. Now, Paul has been in the screenwriting game for a long time. He cut his teeth with 80 sitcoms like Who's the Boss, Amen, Small Wonder, Twilight Zone, Perfect Strangers, and so many more. He is also the best-selling author of Rewrite, a step-by-step guide to strengthening structure, character, and drama in your screenplay. Now, I wanted Paul to come on the show to discuss the rewriting process, which is one of my favorite parts because I find it to be much easier to rewrite as opposed to write. Because once you've got a nice fat piece of meat, you can start trimming the fat much easier than actually creating the meat. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Paul Chicklick. I'd like to welcome the show, Paul Chicklick. Man, how you doing, Paul?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm as good as we can be in this crazy, crazy world that we live in.
It's nuts.
It's nuts. What can be said that hasn't already been said about the times that we are living in? I mean, it's a bad alternative timeline from Back to the Future. It just does not seem real. It hasn't been real for years now, I think, but specifically this last year it's just insane. So I'm waiting to wake up and Marty McFly is going to be there. He's like, come with me. This is the way to go. Go back to
Let's get in the DeLorean.
Let's go back to the future, please.
Yeah, please.
It's insane. So thank you so much for doing the show. I truly appreciate it. Before we get started talking about your book Rewrite, how did you get into the business?
Well, that's a funny thing. When I graduated from college, I went to Europe because I wanted to be a novelist. Mm-hmm. I had lived in Europe as a junior in college in Madrid. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I think I'll go back there and I'll write a book, right? Because I was 21 years old and stupid. I got there. It was kind of crazy, but I ended up living in London after that for 4 years. Came back here. And I just took whatever job I could get. And that was translating because I was a fluent Spanish speaker by that time.
Oh, nice.
And teaching English as a second language. And I got stuck in that world for 7 years. And one day I became an administrator at Long Beach Community College. And one day I was standing at the board, at the blackboard, substituting for one of my teachers. And the little voice inside my head said, "This is not the plan." And
he's in your head too. Got it.
Yeah, that same guy. So I decided I wanted to go back to writing, and I did some research and found out that the average novelist makes $750 a year. At that time,
that's ambitious. Actually, that's pretty ambitious.
Yeah. So I looked into what does a screenwriter make, and I thought, oh, that's much better. So I started taking classes in screenwriting at UCLA Extension, and I wrote a play. I had written a play by that time called Casanova Goldberg.
And sounds fantastic.
Isn't that a great title?
You had me at Casanova Goldberg.
Yeah. So I sent it around to a couple of agents, and one agent, Casanova Goldberg, to tell you very shortly about what it's about. It's about a guy that works in one of those Catskills hotels as the Toomler, the guy that programs all the entertainment and stuff like that. And he's an older man. He's like in his 60s or 70s. And he gets a new assistant, and he falls in love with her, even though she's in her 20s. So, all right, the reason I tell you this is because I pitched it to this agent. He read it, and it turns out he was 78 and had an 18-year-old girlfriend. So he understood exactly what this was about.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, he got me out there, and he got me my first job on something called Guilty or Innocent.
Okay.
Which was my first, it was a crazy thing. So anyway, that's how I got in the business. And then one thing led to the other.
Oh. Isn't it funny that one of my first jobs in the business was a translator as well?
Oh, really? I
was a Spanish translator for Nickelodeon's Global Guts. It was kind of like a show of, kind of like an obstacle course show, like back those like, you know, Double Dare and those kind of things for kids. Sure. And they had an international wing, and they came in, and I called my my listeners know that I'm Cuban, so I'm from Miami, and I speak fluent Spanish. But then I do much more because my wife is South American as well, so now my Spanish is much better. But then I only spoke Cuban Spanish, which for people who don't know Cuban Spanish, it's not proper, but
it's incomprehensible.
It's sometimes, you know, it's like Tony Montana, like really, really bad Tony Montana, but I could understand and I could defend myself. No problem. And I called my parents up and I go, "Hey, I got a job at Nickelodeon being a translator." I'm like, what are you translating? I'm like, Spanish. And they go, "Well, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man rules." And,
a vote of confidence.
And I'm like, true. And by the way, it was great. But that's how I kind of got my way into Nickelodeon when I was a PA, doing PA work and stuff. That was
funny. Well, I've worked in Spanish and I taught in Spanish around the world. Yeah. I've taught in Venezuela, Chile, Cuba, Spain.
Wow.
So it's been quite a career.
Now, you've worked a lot in sitcoms. You were working a lot in the sitcoms in the 80s and the 90s. I have to kind of go through some of my favorites of yours, because I mean, when I saw them on your filmography, I was like, well, I have to ask him about this. Small Wonder. I mean, for people don't know about Small Wonder, first of all, the most probable and completely acceptable premise for a sitcom ever. It's absolutely not ridiculous at all. It's completely acceptable, almost as acceptable as Alf. I think Alf was a little bit more believable than Small Wonder. But for whatever reason, Small Wonder still holds, like, because there were so many sitcoms in the 80s. But that one, and that was only a season, I think. Was it one or two seasons, right?
No. They ran five seasons.
Oh, it did run a while.
Yeah. They did 100 shows.
Wow. It did. So it kept going. I always thought it was like a quick run. Great. Well, that's even better. So you did a small run on it. Can you tell the audience what Small Wonder was about, and what was your experience doing that show?
Well, it was a crazy show. I was writing with a partner, Jeremy Birch and Finch, and we were freelancing at the time. And we pitched Small Wonder, which was a show about a computer expert who invented a computer-driven young girl.
An android, so, almost like an android, if you will. Yeah.
A 12-year-old android.
Lifelike.
Yeah.
I mean, physically lifelike, not speaking, but physically.
No. And she spoke with his computer voice. It was very, very strange. We pitched the show to them. We wrote the show. He said, this is the best one that's ever been written for this show, right in front of all his staff, which I thought was really strange. Then he said, after they shot that one, he said, we want to do a sequel. He said, great. So we wrote the sequel. And then he said in front of his staff, guys, what made you think you were professional writers? The complete opposite. So we walked out of there thinking, what the hell is going on? Well, we knew some of the staff and they said to us, that's all right. That's his game. Mm. So I called my agent. I said, you know, I don't know what's going on over there, but why don't you give him a call? She gave him a call. We got 3 more episodes to do after that. So obviously we knew something about how to do the show.
Wow.
It was really strange. We did the last show as well that they shot.
Oh, did you? You did the series finale?
Yeah, the series finale, which was Goodbye Hollywood or something like that. I forget. Hello, Hollywood.
Look, I don't want to tell you what grade I was in, but I was a young man, and I use the word man very loosely back then. I was a young boy when I watched that.
Okay.
And it was I loved it. It was like it was such 80 wonderful 80s stuff. It was just so great. And you also wrote for Twilight Zone, which is, you know, yes, a legendary series.
Well, as a matter of fact, we got the job on Twilight Zone while we were writing for Small Wonder. And we were story editors in Twilight Zone. We should have been producers, but it had Canadian content, so we weren't allowed to have the title. Mm-hmm. But that's what we did. Mm-hmm. We listened to pitches. We rewrote people's work. We wrote several episodes ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that was really probably the best creative experience I ever had in television.
Yeah, you could just jump and you could jump to whatever. Every week was a new adventure. There was no through line. There was no characters you had to kind of pay homage to every, you know, and work with.
Exactly.
It was fresh. It was a fresh short every
week.
Every week
was a new thing. And I would come into work, I would come into work after dreaming and say, I had this dream last night. And it was about a guy who points at a deer and the deer freezes. And from there, we made a show. Or I had a dream about cave drawings. You know about cave drawings, right?
Sure, of course.
And they came off the cave and became real. That became a show. So you could just think about things and bang, you made a show.
And you can't have the EP can't say, well, you know, that's not really what the characters would do. That's
right.
Really not right. The vibe of the show. It's like, and I know they redid it. Didn't they re-release Twilight Zone with Jordan Peele? Was it Jordan Peele or was it Twilight Zone or was it another?
Yeah, they did that.
Yeah.
They did that and they did it again on CBS Prime or whatever it's called. Mm-hmm. So it's had at least 4 different lives. You know, Rod Serling was first, then CBS did it again in the 80s, mm-hmm. and then they did it in syndication. I was on the, I did one for the CBS in the 80s, but then I also ran with Joe Straczynski and Jeremy Bertrand Finch. We ran the show for the late 80s in syndication. We did 30 episodes. Then they did it again on UPN.
That was the one with Forrest Whitaker. Wasn't Forrest Whitaker once?
Forrest Whitaker, correct.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And then they did it again, I guess it was Jordan Peele.
Yeah.
On CBS.
The Prime one, yeah, the whatever the...
CBS Prime, where they're
streaming, all access.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep track of all the...
all the new names.
It's
And they've changed, let's see, I think CBS has just changed it to Paramount.
Is that, no, is CBS and Paramount, is that going to be the same?
I
know Paramount Plus just came out.
Paramount Plus.
It's just coming out.
I thought it was CBS.
It might be. I know they're changing it to something. I don't know.
Who the hell knows?
It's just so, there's so many streaming services. I think that's all going to, I think there's going to be a reckoning for that eventually.
Oh, yeah.
We can't.
It'll be shaken up.
There has to be. There has to be. Something has to happen because spending this obscene amount of money on content, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous on how much they spend.
It's a good time to be a writer.
Yeah, it is. It is a good time to be a writer, especially this last year where you basically just got to stay home and write. It's pretty amazing. You've had a very colorful career in Hollywood, and you decided to write a book to help screenwriters on the process of rewriting, which is something we've really never discussed heavily on the show. And I wanted to kind of dive into the rewrite because it's something that we all do. We all have to do the rewrite. I always like the rewriting process personally, much more than the writing process, because it's like I've got meat that I can shape or mold, clay that I can shape. It's creating the clay that's a big pain in the butt.
Coming up with the original idea, that's the hard part. But actually, the craft is in the writing, is in the rewriting.
Yes.
And, you know, no film gets done without many rewrites. As a matter of fact, I was at a conference at the Writers Guild once several years ago. They were talking about rewriting, and they asked the panel, how many rewrites did your script go through before it got to the stage? And the average was 25. That's a lot of rewriting. Now, it doesn't always mean that you do a big rewrite. Sometimes it's just changing place, changing somebody's gender, taking out a character, putting in a character, whatever, doing a polish. But 25 rewrites, and I've done several films where I've had to do that, 25 rewrites.
Oh, yeah. And then there's these legendary stories of like Stallone writing Rocky in 3 days. And Stallone actually, I saw an interview with him and they asked him that. And he's like, no, I wrote it in 3 days, but I rewrote it for at least another 5-6 months. But that first draft I knocked out in 3 days. So that is true. It's just that was not what you saw on the screen.
Exactly. It never makes it to the screen on the first draft.
Absolutely.
Nobody writes a first draft. Actually, even when I worked on Real Stories of the Highway Patrol, which was a crazy ass show.
Oh my God, yes.
I sometimes wrote 2 or 3 segments a day, but I always rewrote them in the same day. So at least once. But then I would hand them off to the director and they'd shoot it. So it only went through one rewrite.
Because that show was, God, if I remember correctly, like I remember the show vaguely in my head, but it was one of those shows that just, it was a syndicated show, right?
It was a syndicated show and it had 2 kinds of segments. One was a ride along where they just had guy with a video camera.
Like Cops. Yeah, like Cops.
And then we did recreations of special things that the Highway Patrol had done, you know, special holdups or bank robberies or pullovers or shootouts or whatever, and I wrote 265 of those.
Jesus. So that's that was, hey, it was, you gotta do what you gotta do,
I had a family to support and a kid in private school, and you know, shit had to happen.
I know the feeling, my friend. All right, so how do you approach a rewrite?
Well, that is a good question. There's a lot of ways to do it, but the first way, I usually do it in 8 steps. And the first step is you got to read it over again after putting it aside for a couple of weeks and letting it cool off, because you're not really objective enough if you just start the rewrite the next day. So read it after a couple of weeks. And then the first thing you need to do is read it for structure. And there is a structure that we use in Hollywood that's used around the world, really. And most people know it, but I'll just give you a quick review of it. And it's a 7-point structure. That is the ordinary life of the character, the inciting incident, the end of act one, goal and plan, the midpoint where it's a turning point, the low point, the final challenge, which sometimes is called the climax, and the return to normal life. So you make sure that your script has all those points and that you have the connecting tissue for all those points as well. And you make sure all your scenes have those points, because that's the way a good scene is constructed, and make sure that your scenes have conflict. And then you read it over again and you make sure that your protagonist stands out and that your protagonist has his or her own language, that we can differentiate that person's language from everybody else's. And we make sure that your protagonist has a flaw, because if he doesn't have a flaw, there's no development. Your character has to change from the beginning to the end, or it's not going to happen. Michael Caine used to say, I would read a script, the first 5 pages of the script and the last 5 pages of the script. And if the character didn't change, I wouldn't do the show.
Wow. So,
it's a good thing. Your character must change. So that's there. Your antagonist also has to have a goal. Your protagonist has a goal. Your antagonist has to have goals too. Otherwise, they're not in conflict. And those goals have to be in conflict. So you have to make sure about that. And the antagonist has a voice as well. And then you have to check and see, what is the story of the central emotional relationship? That is to say, the person, sometimes called the love relationship, but it's not necessarily that. It's not necessarily a romantic love. It could be two brothers. It could be friends. It could be a father and a son, a father and a daughter, whatever. But you have to make sure that there is a story there too. So there's three stories going on. There's the plot that you know, your action plot that you see. There's the story that's going inside your character's head as he's developing from whoever he was at the beginning to wherever he is going to be at the end. And then there's the story of the central emotional relationship. So you have to check for all those stories. And you have to check to see that the dialogue for all those people fits those people and those stories.
So you're kind of going in as almost as a doctor and doing a diagnostic on exactly. The story. When you're starting to rewrite, you're going in and checking, okay, is this here? Is this here? Is this here? How's the heartbeat? Is the flow going? How's your cholesterol? do you have reflexes?
I've never heard it described like that, but that is exactly what it is. We examine the patient, mm-hmm. We make a diagnosis, and then we make a plan on how to fix it. And the plan is make sure that you have structure, make sure that every scene has conflict, make sure that every scene has structure as well, make sure that all the dialogue is appropriate to the characters, make sure that the action rises and falls where it's supposed to rise and fall, and make sure that it's fun to read. So you also have to go over the description, make sure all the description is terse
and fun,
because you don't want to have a lot of stuff. You know, you described writing as a haiku.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier. Like we were saying, writing is arguably very difficult, just good writing, period. But writing screenwriting is arguably the most difficult form of writing, in my opinion, other than a haiku. Because you can write a poem and then you can write a haiku. And haiku has to be so much more. Every single word has to have meaning. So that the construction of a haiku is so much more complicated and harder than just a poem. Same way writing a novel and writing a screenplay are, you could tell the same story, but it has to be done so differently. So there's so much more tech. It's such a more technical writing. It's a skill set that is, it's not for everybody. You could be a fantastic writer. I know perfect example. So many great novelists. I mean, I don't think Stephen King has ever written an amazing screenplay.
I don't know. Yeah.
His
stories have been the basis of amazing.
He is arguably one of the most prolific and best known and best selling authors of all time, definitely of our generation, without question. But yet, when he's tackled a screenplay, I don't remember. And he has written a few of them, but yeah. they're not Oscar winners, and they're so it's tough.
But yeah. It's a hard thing to do. I mean, there are steps you have to take and there are things you have to keep in mind. But as I was saying about description, you know, it has to be like a haiku. It has to be very succinct, mm-hmm. but it also has to create an image in your mind. So when people are reading it, and you're going to have somewhere between 150 and 5,000 people working on your screenplay, they all have to have a document that they can look at and see the same thing in their heads. Mm-hmm. So that requires you to be very succinct, very clear in your writing, but not writing too much, but still writing enough. So it is a very hard technique to learn, but it's not impossible to learn. So right. That's what I get at my book. There are steps to take that you can do to improve your screenplay at any stage. And as a matter of fact, as I recommend in my book, once you've done your first rewrite, set it aside again, mm-hmm. and do another rewrite.
Now, can we touch upon just quickly structure? Because, and I've talked about this on the show before, but I just want people listening to really get understanding of this. A lot of people's like, oh, I don't go through like, you know, those seven steps. That's going to block me in. That's not creative. You're not, you know, it needs to flow. It needs to go in like, and be a lot of screenwriters,
arguably not professional ones, because I've talked to a lot of professional screenwriters, and all of them, they might not follow the you know, Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, or they might not do it, and some of them might not even been thinking about it. But when they write, they're such craftsmen and craftswomen that they are doing it instinctively. And they've said that. They've said that to me. They're like, I don't think about it. I don't like sit on page 20, this happens. But I go, but on page 20, that happened. He goes, yeah, but I didn't think about it. That's just the way it came out. Can you talk just a slight bit about structure and the importance of it?
Sure. Well, I understand the idea that you want to be free to create what you want to create. But we all understand that most automobiles have four wheels, a transmission, a motor, a steering wheel, a brake, right? And an accelerator pedal, even electric ones. So we all understand that. And how many forms of automobiles have we seen? Thousands. Thousands. I mean, a Ferrari is not a Fiat. They all look different. They all have different purposes. An Indy 500 car is different. The same thing with movies, but you still have to have the steering wheel, the four wheels, the brake, the accelerator, the motor. And so that applies to screenwriting. And there are certain things that work. And it's not always the same thing, and it doesn't always have to be in the same exact order. You can have the 12 steps of the hero's journey, but they can be in slightly different order or slightly more emphasis on one step than another step. Same thing for the seven points that I talk about. This is the way a Hollywood movie is formed. And even when before this paradigm was set out, before Sid Field wrote, you know, here's the three act structure, The Wizard of Oz has it.
Right.
All the other movies that were made at those times had it, because you just instinctively, if you're a good writer, you know that this is what has to happen. Now, we've made it more of a science so that more people can access this kind of art, but you still have to follow it. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't other ways to make a movie. I mean, you make a German movie or a French movie or a Greek movie, they're different. I mean, in a French movie, everybody commits suicide at the end, and, you know, it's sad. In a German movie, everybody suffers, you know, from...
I mean, Fellini definitely didn't work with the standard structure.
Exactly. And those are fine, and those are great, but, you know, those stand up. On the other hand, how well do they do worldwide? Not the same as Avatar, which follows the 7-point, actually follows the 12-point structure. Not the same as Star Wars, which follows the 12-point structure, but also you can lay the 7-point structure right on top of that, and it works perfectly. So... yeah, there are other ways to go about things, but, you know, how many people see Chinese movies? You don't. They don't do well around the world. They do well in China, but they don't do well in the United States. It's not just because they're in Chinese, because we have seen some films that are in Chinese with subtitles. It's because everybody is expecting to be told in a certain way, because we've been expecting that for the last 2,500 years.
Right.
You know, when Aristotle outlined how a story goes in the days of Greek theater, he didn't invent it. He was laying his structure on top of Euripides and Sophocles and all those guys and just saying, well, here's how it goes. His poetics is not something that he just invented. It's something that he saw the structure of and just presented the three-act structure to the rest of the world. So we're used to hearing stories that way, and that seems to be the best way to tell a story. There are other ways to tell a story, and fine if you can make that work. No. I'm just thinking of Koyaanisqatsi. Have you ever seen that movie? Mm-hmm. It was a documentary, kind of a documentary, and it told a story visually, never used any words.
Oh, yes. I remember that one, yeah.
Yeah, crazy, crazy story, but it didn't follow the 7-point structure, but it doesn't matter.
It's art. That, there's a difference between art and commerce. And if you're spending $200 million for a movie, you gotta get a return on investment, and you can't create a $200 million art project.
Well, it can be an art. It can be artistic.
Absolutely.
But it's not an art film.
Right.
You know, so there's room for every kind of film. As a matter of fact, this week I recommend to my class to read a script. One of my classes to read a script every week. So last week they read Deadpool. which is kind of a crazy thing.
Amazing movie. Crazy.
Crazy movie, and it's very big, and it's very action-adventure, and it's very sarcastic, and it's very clever. This week, they're going to read Sideways. Completely different kind of a film.
It's very, very much so.
Right? So, because there are all kinds of films, and there's room for all kinds of films. But if you look at those films, they both, Deadpool and Sideways, both have a seven-point structure. And if you follow that structure, you have the ability to freelance, you know, all kinds of ideas and to just what I call green light thinking. You can think about all kinds of things within that structure, just like you can think of all kinds of different form for an automobile to take.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
What advice would you give killing your darlings, as they say, which is one of the most difficult things for a writer to do? And also, I mean, honestly, for a director in the editing room.
Oh, yeah.
It's like you got to cut out a whole scene that took you 3 days to shoot, or it cost X, but it's not working and all of this stuff. What advice do you have when you have to kill those darlings in your script?
Well, you have to look at your script from a realistic point of view. You have to look at every scene and understand what the purpose is of every scene. And there are only two purposes for a scene. Purpose number one is to move the story forward. If it doesn't move the story forward, you don't need that scene. It can be the funniest fucking scene that you've ever thought of, but it doesn't move the story. Take it out. Second purpose, to tell us more about the character. If you don't tell us something new about your characters, we don't need that scene. So it has to tell us more, something new about the characters and move the story forward, one or the other. If it doesn't do that, you have to take it out. So how do you do that? Well, you read your script and you ask yourself at the end of every scene, does this scene move the story forward? Is there conflict in this scene? Do we see something new? Do we learn something new about the character? If you can't answer yes to those questions, you have to take it out. And if you want to shorten your scene, there's another way to, if it's an important scene and it does move the story forward and it does tell something new about the character, but it's too long, well, there are ways to cut it. First way, you can cut the heads or the tails. So that means enter later and exit earlier. Mm-hmm. So that's a way to cut down your scene. Another way to cut down your scene is to look at every word of dialogue and make sure that every word of dialogue is necessary. Have you repeated dialogue? Do you need to do that? Sometimes some characters repeat themselves on purpose. If you've done it on purpose, okay. Is every word in your description necessary? And I'm talking about every every the, every is. Are they all necessary? If they're not, take them out. So you can shorten. I've never read a script I couldn't cut by 10%.
Wow. Depending on where they are in the rewriting process, obviously, but a fat script. Yes, I get what you're saying. You're right. And I've gone through my scripts before in the past and I've literally just started because it's like, oh, it's too many pages. I've got to cut this down. And then you start going to the descriptions and you get down to that kind of minute level of the does and the a's and can I shorten this sentence somehow as opposed to can I kill those three words? It's just this honing and it's masonry. You're right, chiseling and honing the corners.
The other analogy I use is sometimes sculpting.
Yeah.
So you cut a piece of marble out of the mountain. You have a block. Now where do you go? Well, you cut away as somebody asked Michelangelo how he did the Pietà.
Yeah.
He said, I just took away everything that wasn't the Pietà.
Well, such a great
yeah. That's easy. But no, first you carve a kind of a rough copy of the shape that you want. And then you start carving it down and down and down. And then you polish it and you polish it a little bit more and you smooth it. And it's a process. You don't do it on the first cut.
Yeah.
You don't cut it out of the mountain as the Pietà.
You can't, even a master like Michelangelo could not do that. Because it's just not the process. It's not the process of any art form almost. You could always go back and tighten and tweak.
You have to go through the process.
Yeah.
You have to respect the process.
And I think that's something that a lot of screenwriters don't do, especially young screenwriters who are new to the craft. They don't understand the amount of work that is needed to really hone a screenplay to a place where it's good enough to even be read. And then I'm not even talking about the idea. I'm not even talking about if it's marketable. I'm not even talking just the craft of a good, well-written screenplay. That's why a lot of agents, and please correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of agents and managers will read a script and like, yeah, this will never get made, but I see the talent here. Now let's put him on a project or get him into a writer's room because he or she will be able to do really well, even though this script is dog crap as far as markability is concerned. It will never, ever, ever get made, but I see that they have the understanding of the craft.
Sure. And that's what a good spec script should have. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily a makeable script or shootable script, but it should be crafted. It should be well crafted. We can see not only well crafted, it should have something different about it. It should have that particular writer's voice. Mm-hmm. And that's what really sets it off. Something that speaks directly to the person, and also speaks of the person. Mm-hmm. So that we're talking person to person. And you can see in your head what I was seeing in my head when I was writing the story.
Now, can you talk a little bit about that central emotional relationship with those characters? Can you kind of go deeper into that?
Sure. Every film that you see has a central emotional relationship. Every good film. Not every film is good, but every good film has that.
Yeah.
And romantic comedies are complicated because that is about the central emotional relationship. But there's always something else going on at the same time. Like You've Got Mail had something else going on at the same time. The bookstore story that was going on there besides the romance. So the central emotional relationship is something that... people go to the movies to see. They go to the movies to see people and their relationships with other people, not just action, but their relationships with other people. Even the Fast and Furious franchise, which is, I don't know, they're on
nine. They're on nine right now. But as Vin Diesel says also many times in the movie, it's about family.
Right. Okay. So it's about family. It's not about cars and racing.
Right.
It's about family. It's what we see, the relationship between those characters. That's what's important. And so every film has got a central emotional relationship. The relationship that your central character, your protagonist, has with another character. Usually, as I said before, it could be a romantic relationship. It can be a familial relationship, a father and a son, a mother and a daughter, sisters. But it's always about people. So that relationship also follows a 7-point structure. So there's an ordinary life. Now, let me back up a little bit. That relationship has to either be created or resuscitated in the film. Because a lot of times you'll start off with a film where there's a bad relationship between two people. And they have to fix that relationship along the course of the film.
Like Rain Man would be a great example of that.
There's a good one. Very good. He has to establish a relationship there, and he has to fix the relationship. So we have the ordinary life where they first meet, or we see them individually. Then they first meet, and that would be the inciting incident. Mm-hmm. At the end of Act One, your central character has to think about forming that relationship. I want to be with this person. I want to fix this relationship, whichever one it is. If it's a romantic comedy, I want to be with this person. Or if it's a romantic comedy about divorced people, so I want to fix this relationship. His Girl Friday is about that. That's an old film, but he wanted to fix that relationship. That's what that movie was really about. There's a midpoint where that relationship goes to another level. So it doesn't always have to be a sexual level, but it can be just as friends, they go to another level. But if it's a romantic movie, they go to another level, usually physically. They kiss for the first time, or they make love for the first time. Something happens that's different than what's happened before that. But then they screw up because people screw up. And it's because of their flaw that we talked about earlier, that every character, every protagonist has to have a flaw. And they screw up because of that flaw, and they screw up that relationship at the low point in the film. And now they have to fix that relationship before they can get into the climax of the actual plot of the film. So they have to fix that relationship. They have to overcome their flaw. Then they can go into the climax, or the final challenge, as mm-hmm. I call it, and come out victorious. And then there's the return to ordinary life with your central character and his or her central emotional relationship. And we see them enjoying the fruits of their labors.
All right. And so as you were talking, I'm just running Rain Man in my head. You know, the relationship and the 7 points in that relationship, where I think that next level where they start with Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman finally change the relationship is when he gets dressed up to go to the casino, and mm-hmm. and all of a sudden they're working together as opposed to being completely at each other. Well, not each other's throat. I mean, Tom Cruise is just at Dustin Hoffman does not change. He's, you know, Raymond is Raymond. But then it's followed right afterwards with the low point. One of the low points is that he's like, oh my God, this relationship has changed. We're finally going to be brothers. He goes to hug him and he has a complete meltdown because he can't handle that because – and that's, I felt that was like, I mean, one of the lowest parts of that. It was such a powerful scene. Exactly. Am I right in analyzing that the way?
Exactly, exactly. And you see, that's the part of the film that you remember the most.
Yeah.
And you remember the relationship between those two men. That's mm-hmm. what that film is about.
Yeah.
So
it's all about just, it's such an amazing movie. Like that would never get made in a studio today. It just wouldn't, unfortunately. But the transformation of Tom Cruise's character throughout, from being that just arrogant, cocky, in it for myself, only selfish character, to the end, literally willing to give up everything for his brother. Sorry, spoiler alert, guys, but it's on you if you haven't seen the movie. And being able to give of himself, even though at the end what Dustin Hoffman needs, he can't give him.
Well, that's true. But the Tom Cruise character did change. Remember?
Oh, very much so. Huge change.
The character arc, he changes mm-hmm. from the beginning to the end. He starts with a flaw. He ends up a better person. Mm-hmm. And that's what we go to movies to see.
Yeah. And that's why it was such a huge hit, because it was just, there was no action. There's no explosions. There was nothing. And I think that's one of the things that Hollywood sometimes forgets, depending on politics and other things, is they'll make a movie like Battleship, and they threw every single visual effect, monster, action, which was all executed beautifully on a technical standpoint, but it's shallow because there's no character development. There's no connection. Where then you can watch something like Titanic, which is as action-packed as you can get. It's a very action-packed film. But the emotion, that movie is all about, no one talks about, oh, did you see when the Titanic broke in half? Did you see that scene where the water was rushing in? No. It's all about, why didn't she just hold on to Jack? There was room for both of them on that damn plank.
you know, and it's a Romeo and Juliet story. That story has been told many times.
God, so but beautifully.
It was told, And it's the central emotional relationship that makes us want to go to the movies. Yes, we want to see explosions. We want to see
fun
buildings and all that stuff. But what we remember is what the central emotional relationship was all about. And that has its own structure, just like the structure of the plot, the central plot does.
I bring up Marvel often on the show because it's arguably one of the most, one of the best examples of storytelling in the last decade done at such a high level. Regardless if you like superhero movies, don't like superhero movies, there is something they're doing right. And arguably one of the characters, since we're talking about emotional, central emotional relationship, the character of Iron Man, from the very first time we see him being this arrogant, selfish, self-involved character, from the very moment we meet him to the end of Endgame, where he gives the ultimate sacrifice to save the entire universe. Talk about what a complete change. And they did that over 10 films and or 10 yeah. years. And he, you know, how many films was he in? But he was always part of so many different. But that character arc mm-hmm. is there in that 10 years that they were making films. And it was an emotional, it was absolutely an emotional journey. For that's why people just bawl at the end of Endgame. People who are invested in these characters were just,
yeah.
oh my God. It's just, oh, it's remarkable.
Yeah, well, people go to films to experience emotions. Mm-hmm. This is what Aristotle was talking about 2,500 years ago. People go to cleanse themselves, to cry, mm-hmm. to laugh, to take themselves out, to entertain in Spanish. You know the word in Spanish. It means entretener.
It's entretener.
To hold yourself in the middle, to hold, you know, it's between things. It's to get out of yourself for a moment and to cleanse yourself and to be a different person when you walk out of it. You know, we need entertainment. We need entertainment, and we need entertainment that's emotional. And emotional doesn't always mean crying. It can mean laughing.
Scared.
It can be shouting. It could be anger. Whatever it is, we sure. need all that.
Yeah, and that's the safe way. And that's why during the pandemic, Netflix has exploded and streaming services have exploded, and we're all just clamoring for stories. It was remarkable. It was a human experiment on a global scale of mm-hmm. like, sorry guys, there's barely any real big news movies out for this last year. We've been being promised these films, but they don't come out because of the pandemic. And that's why people like I've binged so many shows. I've gone into shows and just watched shows and shows and shows. And it's because that need of going through that. And it is a need. It's an absolute human need to I love the word you use, cleanse, to cleanse yourself through. Because sometimes when you're feeling down, you go to a funny movie to help you mm-hmm. come up. If you want that thrill of a horror movie, if you're into that, like you really want that kind of like, oh my God, I'm going to die, that adrenaline rush, but I know nothing is going to happen to me. I'm not saying that we do important work, but we kind of do. We're not saving lives. Let's just put ourselves in the scope of what we're doing here, but it is a very important job.
It's a very important job. I mean, I'm just trying to think of a film. Did you ever see Sullivan's Travels?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. Preston Sturges. Well, yeah.
Sullivan's Travels is about the importance of film.
Yeah. Yeah, right? You're right.
So it is important. Television is important. What would we be doing without television right now? We'd be stuck. We'd be stuck. So we would be killing each other.
Yeah, people will be reading a lot more, I would imagine. People will be reading a lot more. Yeah. Do you talk about life support for your protagonist in your book? Can you kind of dive into that a bit?
Yeah, when I say life support, that means your protagonist has to have people around him or her. I say him or her. Sometimes I just say her. Sometimes I just say him. Mm-hmm. But it's always him or her. Or non-binary, if you want to get into what we do now. But the people around your protagonist have to have a reason to be around your protagonist. Why is this person in this film?
Yeah.
Does this person bring out something in your central character that we need to see? Does this person tell your central character something that he or she needs to hear? So supporting characters are really important in films. And we remember these supporting characters if they're good. And so it's something to think about when you're writing supporting characters. Number one, why are they in this scene? How are they helping move the story? How are they helping our protagonist to understand what he or she needs to do? How are they hindering what your protagonist needs to do? So that the antagonist is a supporting character in most films. So these are people that lend reality to films. They lend depth to films, and they give the opportunity to the protagonist to develop as a person within the film. So the central emotional relationship is a supporting character. The antagonist is a supporting character. Even the guy in the clothing shop that makes the espresso in the Eddie Murphy film, Beverly Hills Cop, Do you remember that?
Oh, film? Of course. Yes, yes, yes. The with Perfect Strangers guy. I forgot his name.
Exactly, and I've forgotten his name now. Branson Mitchell.
Oh God. Was it Hans or Serge? Serge.
We remember him.
Yeah.
From that film.
We do.
He stands out, and if you have characters like that, it gives makes a wider, more interesting tapestry in your film, so that we have much more to look at, much more to see, much more to remember.
Now, something like Serge, and let's dive into just real quickly. Serge's relationship with Axel Foley in that movie. I think he came back a couple times in the. It wasn't just a. Was he only in one scene or?
Because I know he's in two scenes.
He's in two scenes. Sure. I think he came in and out, but it was a funny scene, obviously, and it was the purpose of his character, but I think it was also just I'm just trying to think the reasoning why they would put that, other than just being funny. That scene, if I remember correctly, it's been a year since I've seen that movie, but that scene was moving the story very much forward because it was a very crucial part of who killed who and, you know, where the money was and the drugs and all that kind of stuff. And Serge was kind of like a tapestry in that. But at the same time, it kind of also was another fish out of water scene because Axel had never run into a character like Serge ever in his life. So it was a learning experience for Axel as well as for Serge.
It taught us something about Axel. And that's what that scene was there for. It was to open Axel's eyes to the possibility that there are different kinds of people in the world. Mm-hmm. And that they're valuable. And even if they're strange and they rub you the wrong way, they're valuable. So, or the right way. I've never seen a person like that. So what the hell? What the hell's going on here? It opened his eyes. And that's the point of that person. So supporting characters can help your central character, and it can help your audience too, to appreciate your central character.
Have you been watching Schitt's Creek? Have you ever seen that show?
Oh God.
I just finished binging that show a little while ago. Oh so my great. God. Such a great, it's just the characters are so wonderful. The whole town, talk about supporting characters. I mean, the town, yeah. from the diner, the owner of the diner to the boyfriend, the garage, they're all just so wonderfully written and performed.
But you see how the central characters in that story changed.
Oh,
they were so selfish and self-centered at the beginning.
Yeah.
And they all opened up. And it's all about love. That series, five seasons of love. That's what it was about.
You're absolutely right. It was about, and it was a slow process. They took their time carving and chiseling those characters into who they became at the end, where when they first got there, they just want to leave. But at the end, they're like, I don't want to go. Right. Even when given the opportunities to go back to their lives,
the most self-centered were open to sharing their lives with other people, to helping other people, to self-sacrificing.
It was beautifully, beautifully done. Now, in the rewriting process, we were talking about descriptions. Descriptions arguably are one of the two big, difficult parts of writing a screenplay. Dialogue and description obviously are the two major parts of a screenplay. Sometimes, and I heard this from one of my former guests, producers and readers want to see a sea of white on the page, as you know, as little to have to read as possible. And that's a sign of really tight, good screenwriting, as they say. That's arguably, it depends on who you're talking to, because if you look at a Tarantino script, I mean, I mean, it's different.
It's true, but there's a problem there, because you want to make them see the film in their heads. How are you going to make them see it if you don't describe the situation? Now, a lot of people do skip over that, and some directors even cross that stuff out and just go into the dialogue and say, well, we'll create the scene using this dialogue. But you have to have some description. Now, the trick is to spread it out so you don't have paragraphs that are 10 lines long, because people are not going to read it. That's too black. So you have a paragraph that's two or three lines long, or maybe one line long, or maybe one word long. You can do that. And that's a good idea. And then some dialogue. And then sometimes you don't want to have page after page after page of nothing but dialogue either, because that will say, well, what's going on? What's happening? What are they doing?
Unless your name is Tarantino, then you can do whatever
you
want.
If you're Tarantino, you can have 15 minute scenes too.
That's exactly the scene
in the downstairs in that restaurant where
Inglourious Bastards. Yeah. Oh
my God. Inglourious Bastards. I mean, oh my God, what a long, it's 22 minutes, I believe.
The opening sequence of that movie is a masterclass. I mean,
yes.
Oh Jesus.
But on the page, here's the difficult thing. You have to write visually, and they tell you this all the time, and they're looking for this all the time. So that means you have to have description. But on the other hand, people don't like to read description. So what do?
Right.
So you have to write it. You have to sneak it in there. That's why I tell my people not to write more than 4 lines at a time in description. 6 at the most if you have to.
Agreed.
But if break it up into shots to make it look wide, to make it easier to read so that your eyes go down the page faster. So if you break it into shots, for example, if I'm writing about your office right here, I might do a wide shot on the office and I would say Alex is sitting in his office. I don't have to describe every part of your office, but if I want to do something specific about your office, I would say, well, there's a figure of Yoda wearing a cap in the corner. But I would say, I would put that on its own line, mm-hmm. Yoda, and I would capitalize it, Yoda, and then I would skip a line, is standing wearing an overcoat and a cap. Mm-hmm. So we would direct the reader's eye to that. So we would direct the reader to see that in his or her head. And then we would do some dialogue. And then we would get back to some other part of the room.
And isn't it that a lot of times screenwriters, when they're writing screenplays, they try to do it like a novelist. So a novelist, writing about my office, let's say as an example, can go into the detail of Yoda and the laurel, like the lanyards around his neck and the posters on the wall and the sculptures in the back they could write a page just on this office if they felt like, but a lot of screenwriters do that. And I've seen screenplays do that they write 6, 7, 8, 9 lines explaining this room, unless the room itself is the central character. And even then you wouldn't do that. You just don't do that.
No, I tell my students, for example, if we were writing about a college classroom, all you have to say is it's a college classroom. That's all you have to say.
People are going to figure it out. Yeah. Unless it's a specific thing that you need to do. So like in Good Will Hunting, I doubt that they went into a great amount of detail in the hallway that, right. That Will does. The thing is, there's a chalkboard. I'm sure it was just very simple, and it wasn't like this long, like MIT, the hallways are really built, you know, they drip with brick on the wall. Like no one cares.
It's a hall.
It's a hallway, guys. It's a hallway.
Now, if there's something important in that hallway or something important in the classroom, it's a classroom set up for COVID-19.
There you go.
So then we would see a different hallway. I mean, we'd a different classroom. If it's a classroom set up for people with wheelchairs, we would see a different classroom. So if it's important, you write it. But you have to remember that everything that you want to see in the screen that's important, you have to write in your screenplay.
Right.
Everything that's not important, let other people deal with it. And they'll fill it out. Same thing goes for the wardrobe.
Oh, yeah. You don't have
to describe all the wardrobe. I can just say college students, and I don't have to describe what they're wearing. Everybody knows what a college student wears. However, if I describe a college student who's non-binary and is wearing a sweatshirt and green tennis shoes and has purple hair, then that's important. I want to write that.
This character is dressed like he's stuck in the 80s. That's all you need to know.
That's exactly it. You don't have to say big hair, big shoulder pads.
I promise you, whatever you write will not be on the screen. If you go into great detail in what that person is wearing on your script, I promise you wardrobe and the director and the actor will all have their say on how that actor unless it's a completely central part of the story or the character or something in the wardrobe is magical that carries the story forward, then write it. Like you said, if it's important to the story, write it. If not, you automatically get like, oh, they're out of a scene from the 90s. Out of, they look like they just walked off the Friends set. Yeah. Done. You know exactly where that you are.
Yeah. It's all about being very specific and letting people create the image in their own head.
Now, one other thing you talked about in your book, which I found interesting, is that you discuss how to surprise the reader by going outside the rules. Do you have any advice on how to do that? Because it's very similar to like we were saying with Michelangelo, I just took away the stuff that wasn't supposed to be there. It's easy to say that. Yeah, just work around the rules and surprise your character. How do you do that?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Well, that is a tough question because that has, you have to surprise yourself.
Right.
When you're writing. You have to say, what would this character do that I wouldn't expect, but that once I see it makes sense because I know who that character is. Mm-hmm. So that's a hard thing to do. For example, let's say that your character is a police officer and you would expect that character to enter a crime scene and do something, examine the body, look at where the bullets are, see the blood, but you wouldn't expect that person to go down and put their finger in the blood. Mm-hmm. That would make sense if they want to smell it. Do something that's a little bit out of the ordinary, but that makes sense from this character's point of view. So that's harder to say, here's what you have to do. There's no...
It's case by case. It's a case by case basis, but something like... arguably one of the best written shows in history, in my opinion, Breaking Bad, what Vince Gilligan did. I remember the character of Hank, the DEA agent who had the biggest kingpin under his nose the entire time. He had a collection of rocks. Like he collected, he was, I forgot what the term is when you collect rocks. Like, but anyway, he was really into rocks and just like, that's really interesting. And then you start digging into that in your mind. You're like, why did he, like, why did they throw that in there? But it keeps it interesting. It completely is outside of what you think of as a DEA agent.
Right. It's something to give the character more depth.
Something. Yeah. So,
yeah. Well, you don't want to have a two-dimensional character. So right. Every character's got something a little bit different. I mean, I've never met a person that didn't have something unusual about them. One of the questions I ask about my students in the first day of class is, what is your secret talent? Mm-hmm. And they almost always come up with something weird. And it's very, it could be, you know, they can bend their finger back to their elbow, or they can touch their nose with their tongue, or they can play the violin, and or they can do a magic trick. I have them do it in the class. And that gives us depth, but it's also something I do in class to teach people how to write a character. Characters right. will have these things.
That's why a lot of my listeners always freak out when I've mentioned it a few times on my shows. I was like, yeah, I used to own an olive oil and vinegar gourmet shop in Los Angeles. And they're like, what? Like, where did that come from? I'm like, oh yeah, if you need to know about olive oil, I can tell you how to pick a proper olive oil, how to sip it, how to taste it, how to buy it, what's a good 18-year-age balsamic. And they're like, what is that about? Like, so that's like a little, like nobody would ever think that I own the largest olive oil and vinegar tasting shop in Los Angeles in Studio City for 3 years.
I think I was there. I think I've been there.
Which one was it? It was in Studio City right by Laurel Canyon.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That was my shop.
I can't remember that, but yeah. I don't know if you can see this in my, I'm trying to see. Mm-hmm. Can you see that? No, not there. Mm-hmm. Trying to look at it. I've got a circus. I have a poster on the wall mm-hmm. from Circus Vargas. Mm-hmm. Here's a little background.
Oh, I see. I see it in the reflection right behind you.
I can see the reflection. I worked as a roustabout in Circus Vargas.
What's a roustabout?
Roustabout is the kind of the guy that does everything. Mm-hmm. I set up the tent. I put in the seats.
So you worked. You ran away with the circus, is what you're telling me.
I ran away with the circus.
And there you go.
All right. So that's a part of me. Most people don't know, but right. You know, there's a little bit of an interesting thing. Now, why would I bring that up in a movie? Maybe to show that I'm a small person, but I'm by small, I mean, I'm 5'6", mm-hmm. but I'm strong. Mm-hmm. That was the hardest work I've ever done in my life.
Oh, yeah.
The first day I did it, I had blisters all over my hands. The second day I did it, I was wearing gloves, leather gloves that tore. That's how strong, that's how tough the work is. So, and I can describe stuff about the circus. Now, that leads me to something else we haven't talked about, and that's research.
Yes.
And I see this all the time in my students do. One of my students is writing about San Francisco in the 60s. Now, I was there, so I know it. And I know what they said, and I know what they did. And they don't know. And I also had a student once who was writing about Spain in the 1600s. And she was having a messenger come to the door of a noblewoman. Mm-hmm. Now, first of all, the noblewoman answered the door. That would never happen. Second of all, the messenger was delivering a telegram in the 16th century. No, they wouldn't.
not so much. Yeah, they didn't an email. They didn't get text.
No, they didn't get that. So I have my people do research, and research gives depth to the story, depth to the characters. So it's an important part of your writing. If you're writing about something that you're not completely familiar with, you have to do the research. You can't write about what you don't know.
It's so funny because I wrote a script and I had a short film that I wrote about carnival workers, carnies. And I interviewed a carny. And I got what a carny actually did. And if you watch my film, you see things you've never seen in a script because no one had gone that deep into like the after hours of what a carny does and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating because I'm just writing down. It was like, oh, this is all gold. He's just giving me gold, gold, gold as I was interviewing him. And it's amazing. If you look at some of the, like Michael Mann, I know does an insane amount of research when he writes. I mean, he's legendary for his research. Like he handed Jamie Foxx for Collateral, like a binder. I'm like, this is where your character lives. This is his history. Mm-hmm. This is where he went to school. Stuff that will never, ever, ever see the screen. But it gives so much depth to those characters. It's remarkable.
That's why one of the first steps I do, have my students do, is to write biographies of the main characters. Mm-hmm. And in those biographies, we go into depth of where they were born, how many people were in their family, what kind of a family was it. What language did they speak? What school did they go to? How many years did they go to school? What did they study? What did their father do for a living? What did their mother do? Maybe they had two fathers. Maybe they had two mothers. Maybe they were brought up by their grandparents. All these things are important. The deeper you get into the character, the better you're going to write the character. The deeper you get into a situation, the better you're going to write that situation. So research of your character development of your character is important, and research into the milieu that your character is in is extremely important.
And if you're in the rewriting process and you go into a scene or you see a character's, you know, arc and stuff like it's not working, maybe even during the rewriting process, you would go, you know what, let me go into what, like, whatever they're, let's say they're carnival workers. And you're like, you know what, it seems way too one dimensional. You go do research and then you go back into the rewriting process and then you start adding all the nuance as well. So research can be at the beginning and could also be there for life support or helping revive the patient, if you will.
Exactly.
Now,
we're getting back to the doctor analogy of what we're doing with the script.
Right, exactly. Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests. Sure. What are three screenplays every screenwriter should read?
Well, I think every screenwriter should read Groundhog Day,
It's a masterpiece.
It's a masterpiece. Shakespeare in Love. Mm-hmm. Another one.
Great script.
Shakespeare in Love was good. There's an interesting structure. You can lay the 7 points on top of that, but it's a 5-act structure. Mm-hmm. Because Shakespeare's plays were 5 acts.
Right.
And if you look at that screenplay, you'll see 5 acts in it. And I think that's very important. Let me see what else I would do. I would recommend. I thought Inglourious Basterds was a good one.
But like even so, just to touch on Tarantino for a second, if you look at Pulp Fiction, which is completely all over the place story wise, the storylines, it's not a coherent story from beginning to end. If you still lay the points down,
they're there.
The brilliance of that script, because even though the character is in a completely different place in the timeline of the story, in the timeline of the script, it's still following that structure. And that is the brilliance of mm-hmm. of Pulp Fiction. Am I correct?
Yes. I'm trying to remember. There's another screenplay I recommend, and suddenly I can't remember the name of it. It's Memoria. What is the one that starts backwards?
Oh, Memento.
Memento.
Yeah, Nolan's Memento, yeah.
Yeah. Also, that's a very interesting screenplay because it's told in reverse order.
I know.
But the color, the thing that's in color is in reverse order. The stuff that's in black and white is in forward order. Both of those stories have 7 points.
It's insane. No, that's another script that you just, him and his brother wrote that, and you're just sitting there like, I just...
Do that.
That's Nolan. I mean, now Nolan is who he is, but I mean, just absolutely brilliant. Great scripts. Now, what advice would you give a screenwriter trying to break into the business today?
That's the hardest question there is. Mm-hmm. I would say write and then write some more. And I would say then write some more and rewrite it. So you have to have at least, if you're a screenwriter or a television writer, you have to have at least 3 original screenplays ready mm-hmm. to go, in preferably in 3 different genres, I would say, because you never know what people are going to be looking for. And write from your heart. Write something that you really know. Don't write something about 17th century Spain if you don't know it, mm-hmm. because it's not going to work. Write something you really know and put your heart into it, and then rewrite it a couple of times. Then rewrite it a couple more times, and then start asking around and going to events. Well, when we can.
Virtual events.
Go to as many virtual events as you can. But as soon as we can go to real live events, go to real live events and start talking to people. And it doesn't matter who it is. You can go to a Screen Actors Guild event and talk to a screen actor. You can go to a Directors Guild event and talk to a costumer. You can go to a Writers Guild event and talk to somebody that is a first AD. They all know people. You know who the best people to talk to are? Makeup and wardrobe people. Because the best thing to do for a new screenwriter is to get a star attached to it. And who talks to stars more than wardrobe people and makeup people? Nobody. Mm-hmm. So if you can talk to a makeup person and say, so what have you been working on? And I'll tell you, well, I've been working on Schitt's Creek. Really? Well, would you be comfortable reading a script I have that I think Daniel Levy would be really good for? Well, yeah, sure. Why not? And they read it and then say, yeah, I think Dan would be great in this.
Let me call him real quick.
Can I show it to him?
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Yeah, I'll call him real quick. Yeah.
I'll call him because they're the people that know, that can call them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can talk to agents and managers and do the same thing, but I think talk to the craftspeople. You can even call the cinematographer, talk to a cinematographer, or talk to a props person. Props persons know the actors, too.
Oh, yeah. Some of my first big – I got an Academy-nominated actor because my DP worked with him on a film, and he just called him up. And
that's how it works.
It's you're absolutely right. One of the best pieces of advice on screenwriting I ever got was from the screenwriter of Fight Club. When I asked him that question and he said, what you need to do is sit down and you write a script. When you're done with that script, don't rewrite it, take it, put it in a drawer, start writing a script number 2. When you're done with mm-hmm. that script, take it, put it in a drawer, start writing script number 3. When you're done with script number 3, go back to script number 1 and start rewriting it. Because by that time you've already become a much better writer.
Exactly. He's totally right. He's totally right. The more you write, the better you write.
Absolutely. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Film industry or life. Well, in the film industry is when to keep my mouth shut and when to talk.
Great advice.
And in life, that applies.
Oh. Preach, my friend, preach. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. God, the stuff that came out of my mouth when I was in my 20s, I would just be like, just shut up. It's not about you.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not about you. Please just shut up.
It's about making the product.
Yeah, it's about making that show, that movie, whatever you're working on.
Making it better.
Absolutely.
That's your job.
And where can people find out more about you and your work and your book?
Well, I'm all over Google. You can always Google me. IMDb. You can go to MWP.com, which is Michael Wiese Productions.com. They have all the books that I've written on screenwriting. That's only two, but they also have a ton of books about making films. I think it's the best film publishing house there is. And they work with people. So if you have an idea for a book, those are people to talk to. To find out more about me, just go on the web. I'm there. I'm all over the place.
Not hard to find. Not hard to find. And I'll put all that information in the show notes. Paul, it is. Thank you so much for being on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, my friend.
It's really been fun. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
I want to thank Paul for coming on the show and dropping those knowledge bombs on the tribe. Thank you again, Paul. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to get his book, Rewrite, a step-by-step guide to strengthening structure, characters, and drama in your screenplay, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/113. And guys, if you haven't already, head over to screenwritingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you again for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.